Hello and welcome to This Anthro-Life. I'm your host, Adam Gamwell. Now, when we think about social science and social scientists working out in the world, we tend to jump to the science part. You know, jobs that focus on research, like consumer research or user experience research or qualitative studies for nonprofits. But if you have any experience with therapy, you know, whether as a patient or a therapist, or worked with a career or a life coach, or anything to do with conflict mediation, you might have noticed there's more than a little overlap with the skill sets of anthropology. Now, I've been really fortunate to get to know Nethra Samarawickrema. Nethra is an anthropologist, a coach, a writer based out in Sausalito, California. Her work is grounded in this wonderful mix of ethnography, design thinking, and a little thing called nonviolent communication. She's also the co-founder of the Listen Up Lab, where they run workshops on unblocking your writing potential, on collaboration, and on how to have difficult conversations. And through her coaching practice, which she calls Listen Up, she brings this transformative capacity of empathy and helping people discover their own needs. It's really powerful. She provides this kind of space where people can express all their complex and messy and contradictory feelings and access really what they most want to bring into their lives, but they've been blocking from themselves. And as we'll cover in today's conversation, when you can actually unlock this space, radical and dramatic transformation can take place. Now, it's funny because I'm the host of this podcast and, you know, I often ask most of the questions, but Nethra found a way to not only answer my questions, but also to be in conversation with me and to make me feel heard and listened to. So I got to see this form of nonviolent communication in action for my own eyes and my own ears. And now, because we're on a podcast, for your own ears too. And fun fact, Nethra was brought to my attention by a fellow TAL listener. So I know I forgot to ask your name before I put this in here, so just want to say thanks, and you know who you are. Nethra reveals the common connection between anthropology and nonviolent communication that drew her to both, and shows how they complement one another for skill sets in professional and personal lives. Think about things like withholding judgment, active listening, and situated perspectiveness. Now, if this episode sounds good to you, I highly recommend you check out our conversation with Jeremy Pollock on how to manage social conflict, communicate effectively, and find common ground. These episodes complement one another really well, and I dropped the link in the show notes for you to check out after this one. But now, let's get to the conversation. Nethra, thank you so much for joining me today on the podcast. It's really a delight to be able to speak with you and hear your story. I know there's a ton of really exciting things for us to talk about. And one of the common things we like to do is think about your superhero origin story. How did you find your way into, what about anthropology called your name at some point, and what did that look like?
Thanks for having me on the podcast. First, it's such a delight to be here with you and to share this journey of anthro within and beyond the academy. So I just want to start by saying I'm really glad to be in a shared space of thinking and dreaming together. About my story into anthropology, I would say the thing that captivated me the most about anthropology was this notion of situated perspectives. It's the thing you learn about in Anthro 101. And I was someone who grew up in Sri Lanka. I came to the US for undergrad and then grad school. And I had a real sort of yearning to go back and do fieldwork in Sri Lanka. And it was this process of actually finding the familiar defamiliarized. And so my research was on the gem trading world of Sri Lanka and the Indian Ocean region. I worked with mine workers, I worked with traders from different parts of the Indian Ocean region. And the constant question was, how can I stay in a space of unknown to begin to see if I can get close to what the experience is like from their perspective rather than my own? And it was the listening process that was the most sort of enticing thing about anthropology for me. And it's ultimately what drew me out of the academy as well.
Funny how that can happen, you know. So tell me a little bit about that. There is something that's fundamentally powerful about one of the base anthropological dictums of, as you mentioned, making the strange familiar and the familiar strange by trying to see something that might be familiar to you as if it was something that was quite different or not what you expect, or seeing it with beginner's eyes, we might say. Mm-hmm. And what was that experience like for you? And how did that play into this idea of thinking about what does it actually mean to listen? I love this idea too, because so much of anthropology, especially field work, is collecting in data and interviews and observing and trying to get a sense of what's happening in this world. But one of the big challenges that we can run into is that we're the insider outsider. So it can be hard to get people to share stories sometimes. And so I'm curious how listening helped with that process, because oftentimes we find we come in as an outsider. And it's a curious thing that I certainly felt too in fieldwork, that I think listening is a profoundly important piece of providing space. But I'm curious about your experience in that and how listening played that role in kind of opening up or cracking the nut, as it were, of what's happening right in this world.
Yes, I love the question. I think with fieldwork, listening happens at so many different levels. But with fieldwork, I think one of the big questions was, you know, you go in with all your preparation, right? Your theoretical frameworks, the thing that your research question, the thing that you're on a mission to figure out. And that thing is the thing that's important to you and to the discipline. And then there's the question of what's important to the people you work with. And so much of fieldwork for me was actually through the course of fieldwork, slowly let go of the thing that I thought I needed to know. And to discover actually what was important to be understood from the perspective of the people I was working with. And I love how Rosaldo, you know, in his article about Grief and the Headhunter's Rage, he talks about if your question doesn't change over the course of fieldwork, something has been missed, right? It was being in the unknown and an ongoing question of how do I need to listen for what is significant for them to share? I'll give you an example. I worked with mine workers, and these were wageless workers. They worked for sometimes 6 months without a wage for a share of the profits of the gems that they would find. And sometimes they wouldn't know, you know, whether they would even find gems. So the work that I did was very speculative work, and they were speculating with their labor. They weren't speculating with capital. It was really with their own bodies that they were putting at risk. And the narrative was that these people were wasteful, that they were gambling with their lives, like gambling with their time. But they said, we don't want to do any other work. So the question was, why? What meaning did they find in their work that I could not see coming in with my sort of Marxist notions of exploitation? Right?
Yeah.
And that was the thing. It was this long process of being like, how can I, even in solidarity, hold my own outrage at the fact that they weren't being paid, hold that aside and ask really what was happening in there? What was the work of their work for them?
No, I love that too, because it really holds this notion that work is not necessarily alienating in the way that we might take from a Marxist perspective, or imagine it also was, but at the same time, it's not only this, but the notions that we might come into the field with in terms of what's happening with labor exploitation. I don't own the means of my own production and elements like that, which are valid in terms of framing and how we can think about labor and work. But at the same time, I think this is a beautiful example that we take something that sounds like very speculative labor of one's body and one's health, right? Mining is an incredibly dangerous industry in anywhere in the world, really. And then we can, I'm also thinking of examples of coltan mining that we've seen in parts of East Africa as well. And so this interesting notion of this like very dangerous type of labor that also has the speculative angle to it, but similarly, this work has a meaning to it that is not purely capital-based, right?
Right.
And I love your point in how to think about, how do I learn to listen to what that is? So if we can think to other graduate students or anthropologists or social scientists that might be in the field or thinking about field work, how do we help that framework of listening be part of the equation?
Yes, and it's one of the things that it's a very humbling experience. It's a humbling experience on two counts, which is that you come away with all your exams, right? You do your comprehensive exams, you read 300 books, right? Or whatever is expected of you. And then you go and you realize you're clueless.
Yeah.
When you're in the field and you're lost, all of that flies out the door. And to me, that is where the real work begins. To me, I think there was another tension that happened, which is you can never know what another's reality is. But I think fieldwork brings us a little bit closer and to at least understanding what the significance of what people are doing for themselves. But then there's that work of translation when you get back from fieldwork, back into academic life. And then there's this sense of what knowledge is significant to produce. And I found myself at this tension between the world that I wanted to convey that was very much an ethnography from the ground up, that had to do with what was significant for the people I worked with and the places that I worked in, and this pull to create an intervention that was significant for anthropology and for the field. So there was this constant tension about who is this knowledge being produced for. Mm-hmm. And for me, that was where I really hit writer's block in a profound way, because I realized that to honor the deep listening that I wanted to do and to convey the things I wanted to convey meant that I had to hold at bay the pressure to perform and the pressure to produce the kind of knowledge that would sort of move me further along in the academic track.
That's a profoundly important point, in that we're not here to necessarily shame graduate school, but it's worth raising these questions, I think, because you're 100% right that there is this tension between what do we find in experience in the field when we're trying to practice radical empathy, and ourselves are quite vulnerable bodies and selves in a state of flux, right? I think there's some deep truth to the idea that can the anthropologist ever really go home? Years later, I started calling it feeling like you're unmoored, like the boat, the ship is off the dock, but it's not sinking. It's just in the water. It's not really anywhere right now. You find some semblance of home in field. You have some semblance of home from where you were before you went to the field. And then returning from the field with this new set of experiences and knowledge that I think you wonderfully said too about how do we actually think about this from the ground up? But then we get hit with these questions of what is the knowledge that we need to produce to move X forward, and X ultimately then it's X or Y, and X weighs more if it is the academy and anthropology or the field, and Y is the people's experiences that we actually spend time amongst. And I think that is profoundly difficult. So it's like writer's block, it sounds, played an important role in reshaping your thinking about what would come next.
Yes, I joke about it as like a profound gift of writer's block, because in getting out of that block, I actually found my way into doing what I'm doing right now, which brings me so much joy, which has a thread of continuity with what I loved about anthropology and fieldwork. So I think for me, something I take responsibility for, and I've seen in so many other people, and I think that it's not just within the academy, I see this in so many different fields as well, which is this feeling of being stuck between the things that you want to say when you write, for instance, and then fearing that will not be acceptable, and trying to balance this tension in anthropology that was like, what's my big intervention? What's my theoretical takeaway? What's my argument? And that had a very kind of external focus, right? Because of the publication process, because of even writing like job applications and postdoc applications, you're constantly like framing the thing that you know, or reframing it to fit into something that's external to the thing that you did. So that was my struggle. I'd be very open about it. It was a complicated process. And I think for me, I just couldn't do it. I was stuck. And so interestingly, alongside my graduate training, I had started to explore conflict mediation. And the way in which I did this was that I was interested in process practice framework called nonviolent communication, which was something that Marshall Rosenberg, who's a clinical psychologist, had created many years ago and is practiced worldwide now in conflict resolution. And I started going for workshops and classes that really focused on listening. And one of the things that I found, and this was complete accident and it was a surprise, a couple of times a week I would be in San Francisco taking these workshops. And I had a very stark experience where I would show up at these workshops and I would be at the other end where someone else was doing the listening. And I was just speaking and I was sharing whatever was happening for me. And it was this startling feeling of actually saying whatever was happening in the messiest, most inarticulate way, having the freedom to be inarticulate, and knowing there was a person at the other end who was really interested in understanding what was real for me. So it was this first glimmer of feeling of, I don't have to perform, and being like, I can be in an inquiry into myself and my own experience and be supported in that, in all of its messiness, and be heard. And then we would switch roles and I would do the listing and I would see that same feeling of relief in the other person's eyes. And then I would wake up the next morning, I'd come back to my books and my writing, and suddenly I would find that my mind had cleared. And it was the days after I had taken those workshops that the most lucid writing happened. So it was this odd experience that I had initially of when I'm in a conference or if I'm in a space where there was a lot of debate and I had to defend my ideas, a part of me was shutting down. And I couldn't actually access the things that I really wanted to say because of the pressure of that performance. But once I was heard, the writing flowed. So that was the first flash of being like, there's something really interesting here. What is happening?
That's wonderful. I love the idea that there is this often unspoken, but I'm actually thankful to see that people are more and more pointing out the pressure performance in most social roles, but especially in the academic circuit and in so many kind of roles that we have, and recognizing that there's something profoundly important about being able to let go of that. It's awesome to hear that there's this okay space for messiness. And really, I think that's sometimes what can be the deepest desire when you're trying to structure the most structured thing of all time, a dissertation, an argument that you have to write a book for the first time. For many of us, the last time. That is also, as you said too, fundamentally about what is the argument that someone's going to debate with you. Yeah. And that requires a desire to perform that certain way. And I think that we aren't taught or told that, and nobody's hiding it from students or learners, but we often, I'm using graduate school as an example, but also just in life in general too, that we don't acknowledge the performance as such a key part of these kinds of roles, to the extent that then we like take them to be cemented and fully serious. Like we reify them, to use a $10 word, that they're real. But then we get these moments, these workshops, in this case, in your story, in a nonviolent communication workshop, that let that veneer go down. And there's a realness, it sounds like, that's behind that I think is so powerful. And it's amazing to then see or hear that, like, after that, the writer's block took a break for a little while.
Right. Yes,
it's almost like learning to attend to when we're blocked and why.
Yeah, I love that word, attending to when we're blocked and why, you know? And I think that, and that has been a journey of inquiry. And I think I also want to humanize this process of performance, because I think that graduate school is one crucible in which this, you know, really bubbles up. But I see tenured professors still struggling. I see people at the end of their career still feeling that pressure. And I see it outside the academy as well. Now I work with people in tech. I work with artists, and that tension between what's real inside and what will get me legitimacy outside, I think, is an ongoing struggle for so many people in so many different contexts.
Mm-hmm. That's so wonderfully said too. And I think that's such an important and profound piece. This is actually one of the pieces that ironically inspired me to want to go to graduate school. Was anthropologist Michael Jackson, not the pop star, but the New Zealand anthropologist, built a theoretical framework on existential anthropology. And it was built a bit on this axis where there's always this tension between who I think I am and who I feel that I am on the inside, and then what the world tells me that I am. And so I hear it in echo in what you're saying here too. And so part of this work is actually humanizing the performance. And you're 100% right. This is not about graduate school at all. This is an example, but we see this in the professional world with how we act with our families on some level, with how we act with our friends, with who I am if I'm out on a bike ride. Performance is part of who we are. And it's interesting that anthropologists will talk about people as actors. And I didn't understand that for a long time. I was like, we're not faking it. Right. We're not, but we are also acting. But there is, I think you're right, there is this fundamental tension between what's real inside and what will also give me that kind of external legitimacy. I think providing more real spaces for that is fundamentally important. And this idea of nonviolent communication, I think, is fascinating and great. And I think the world needs more of it, but I want to ask a really dumb question. What is nonviolent communication the opposite of? Is it typically violent communication?
I love the question. And this is something, the name nonviolent communication is something. I can't speak for Marshall Rosenberg. I think that it's a name that is the closest thing I think he could find to name the thing that he created. Again, I can't speak for him, but I can speak from my own perspective of my experience of it. And if there is an opposite to it, it's communication that is full of judgment and is communication that is evaluative, that disconnects people, that puts people in boxes. and alienates them from their own needs and from each other. So what nonviolent communication as a framework does is that it's about really supporting people in listening for their own needs and listening for the needs of other people, which are not easy to get to. So for me, it's a very beautiful process of actually looking underneath the surface of the words that people say, the actions that they take, to understand what is it that's driving them to do the thing that they're doing or to say the thing that they're saying. And I think this is where my attraction to NVC and my attraction to anthropology came from, a similar source, which is really this pull towards understanding and curiosity about what is going on behind the surface that we can't see. And there's a very kind of humanizing quality about that, that you don't have to be in agreement with someone to see the world from that perspective. And one of the things that I have really gained from NVC is this capacity, both in terms of the way in which I have learned to listen, but also been listened to, is you make space available for people to express the messy, contradictory realities that they experience. And you're not trying to move someone in any particular direction when you listen, but you're really trying to capture the heart of their experience and then ask them if you really understand it.
Mm.
And if you don't understand it, they can tell you that you didn't get it. Now I work as a coach, and what I really try to do is support people in accessing what's really happening inside them. It's providing a space for them to go inside and find their own answers.
I love that. That sounds amazing. And number one, sign me up for a coaching session. But thank you for articulating that super clear. I think it's so important to hear, just to think about, and giving us a moment as humans ourselves listening to this podcast, or how do we listen? And are we taking the time to hear where the other person is coming from and why? And I love this idea that conversation is not about convincing somebody of something or getting your point across.
Mm-hmm.
It's really about providing space that one can be in verse with someone, in essence. And listen, did I understand that? I love this idea too of, like, how does this help us get a sense to what's really happening under the surface? Did you find that when people would participate in these events, or yourself too, in a session or two, that on one level, this sounds like really nice therapy, and it sounds like more conversation affirmation than one often gets from a therapist, from personal and experiences of folks that I've talked with. And that's interesting. So I want to talk both about, like, you're doing a lot of amazing work right now too. And so I want to use this as a segue to move into that space, because a lot of your work is, to my understanding, and you let me know if this is right or not, or how much I get so far, is that a lot of this, your work is premised around these similar ideas too, in terms of how do we open up that space and provide that kind of space for people to become into a space that they can flourish in. And it's nice because it requires messiness to get there. know? So I think that's super exciting. And I think it's also very exciting, not to sound like a nerd, but honestly, from a perspective of a practicing social scientist that does this work out in the world, is super important to see, because you work with tech. And I don't know if you see this very often. If folks decide not to go into the academy or want to look for any kind of work outside in a practice space, the largest space that gobbles people up is user experience, or UX.
Right.
And I'm not going to hate on UX at all, because we need it to make our software and services better. But there's so many other kinds of work that we could do. And so I think that's also, I think, why I'm very excited to be talking with you now. And part of it is this, is that some other kinds of profound work that don't require a computer screen. So you mentioned before that you love the kind of work that you're doing. It's about work that makes one feel alive, in essence, which I love this idea. So tell me a bit about how you've been through the process of rebuilding, working with the messiness, adding in nonviolent communication. I also just throw in there that we mentioned before that you have looked into design thinking as other kinds of methodologies. And so tell me a bit about the amalgamation, the melting pot of methods and ideas that have come to shape the way that you're approaching your work and career now.
Yes, I'm happy to share. It has been a very messy journey, just to say that upfront. A couple of things happened, a few key moments. One moment was when I was writing my dissertation and I was reading Marx's 1844 manuscripts on estranged labor. And I was reading them to see if I could understand some things that I had found in my fieldwork. And I was gobbling up the text at such high speed that I was realizing, no, actually, I'm now reading for myself. And the phrase that really stuck out to me about what Mark said about a strange labor was that labor is alienated when the work that you're doing, the worker is outside of themselves at work and inside of themselves only when they're away from work. And that line really stayed with me. And the other line that really stayed with me was that when the process of work itself is alienating, the worker is also estranged from themselves, right? They're not just estranged from the process of work. It's also a kind of self-estrangement that happens. And so this describes this feeling I was struggling with, that it felt like I was outside of myself when I was writing. And I was only inside of myself when I was away from the page. And the question was, what is work that would really bring me back inside? That was my guiding question. And I went back to the feeling I felt when I was in these workshops, that I could go inside in the presence of other people. And I had that feeling of aliveness. I also remember that writing made me feel alive at some point in the past, you know? Mm-hmm. And so the question was, how can I get back that excitement of being in front of a page and discovering things? That was when I stumbled upon design thinking as a part of a process of trying to unlock myself. So I took, you know, I read up on it. I took a couple of classes at the Stanford Design School, and eventually it would lead me to meeting my collaborator, who's a designer. And I can say a little bit more about this later. His name is Yuri Zaitsev, and we've started the Lab for Listening together. But the piece that I got from design thinking was a very basic idea, actually, that the creative process is a process, and it requires messiness. That basically you don't need to know what you're creating. You discover it as you go along. And using some of the methods of design thinking, like mind mapping, I started to realize that, oh, actually, I could get all of the ideas out, including the ones that I thought were ridiculous, and then see what happened. So most of the second half of my dissertation writing was actually writing into the dark, writing like without knowing what I was going to say, allowing myself to forget the outcome and be in the process, and asking myself, like, what gave me pleasure and joy in doing it? So if I needed to write, I wouldn't write. I would go for a walk and take a notebook with me. And I would realize that was when the words would flow, when I was actually not trying to put words on a page. So I started to do this for myself. And then Yuri and I taught a class at the Stanford Design School that was not about writing, but it was about listening. And that was an incredible experience, because now we were able to put what I had learned from nonviolent communication and what he brought as a designer from design thinking together and support people in creating a space for whatever they were experiencing to be expressed, to be held in a non-judgmental container. And so that 8-week course like completely transformed the two of us. And what we saw in our students is incredible. And that was a process of relational listening. It was like listening to each other. So people had brought situations in their romantic relationships, at work, with families, all of the messiness of social relations. After that, we discovered that we also wanted to think about listening to oneself and to do that through writing. And that was when we started to design a series of workshops, including one called Flow, where we supported writers in really asking this question of what conditions do I need to create for myself to allow the words to flow? And how can I bring myself enough safety for the voice inside me that's dying to speak to actually come out and speak?
We're going to take a quick break. Just wanted to let you know that we're running ads to support the show. So thanks for tuning in.
I'm curious there, did you find that for writing of any kind, right? This isn't have to be for a class necessarily. But I'm curious too, in terms of for those tense moments when somebody is in class, how this can be a super powerful way of freeing yourself to actually just speak. And I think what you're illustrating beautifully before too, in terms of when I need to write, I'm going to grab a notebook and take a walk. I'm not going to be sitting and making myself looking at a cursor on a blank page.
I think specifically in the classroom setting, like I remember one of our students said, this is the first class in which I feel safe to speak. And this is an engineering PhD student, like really so accomplished. But it's that performance. It's that fear of getting it wrong. And so I think a part of being able to speak is that the space itself needs to be safe. There's an internal component, and then there's a structural and relational component. So if a space is not safe, doesn't feel safe, I encourage people to be very careful about where they speak, because you want to be gentle with yourself and you don't want to make yourself vulnerable to being shut down and silenced. So I think that's what comes up for me. The question is like, how can we actually create classroom, which ideas can flow, which is a challenge.
Yeah, 100%. And I'm thinking about this in terms of like yourself too. I've taught classes for years. I'm taking an academic break right now for however long, I don't know. But I last taught in springtime of 2020. Good timing to take a break from teaching. Not planned, but it was a easy, let's take a break here. But I think you're right in terms of that there is actually a lot of emphasis and pressure on teachers and professors and teachers of all ages, K through PhD and beyond, that there's a desire to make the educational space, classroom, more of a safe place. But it's interesting in terms of how we can help balance that and provide, as you noted, like both the relational space to have these safe area in a way that doesn't feel forced, in a way that doesn't feel contrived. And I don't mean to sound denigrating in terms of how we're putting together classrooms, but it's a huge challenge, especially in terms of that we know that there's rising incidences of mental health issues on campuses around the world. And more students are bringing in, I'm putting in air quotes, if you're not watching this, external stressors in terms of family or work life. Yeah. And more students work while they're in school. And what does it mean to provide that kind of safe space and an area that one can both, you know, share their internal self, but then also still function as a classroom is an interesting challenge, because it's not traditionally what a classroom has been for. That's the main challenge, right? We didn't structurally build them to work this way. But what I'm hearing from what you're sharing is that there are glimmers that we can find new ways of providing that kind of space. I don't know what the answer is, but we're finding, I think, more and more in this space that the inside is trying to come out more and more. And so how do we honor that, is the question.
Yes. And this is an experiment that Yuri and I continue to run in our workshops. And it's an experiment we ran in our class. But I can tell you what I've seen that has actually been helpful and has been surprising for us also, is to create a space in which people have safety. The word safety is it's like an empty term now. Everyone uses it all the time. But maybe a more precise way of saying it is to create a space in which people can go into their own inquiry in the presence of others and to share that inquiry while being in a process that is incomplete and unfinished, and to access what, again, makes them feel alive. So one of the things that we've done, for instance, in Flow is rather than talk about writer's block, we would put people in breakout rooms and we would ask them to share with each other a moment in which the writing flowed without them. And when one person is talking, all the other person is doing is just listening and saying, okay, this is what I heard from you. Did I get it? So they're not agreeing. They're not putting their own perspective in. They're not saying, oh, I have another technique. All you're doing is just taking in the person's experience, sharing what you heard, and checking in if that was accurate. And what we've seen in that process is people have, the words actually come when I'm not afraid of being judged. The words actually come when there's something inside me that I want to express. The words come when I'm relaxed, when I feel some kind of either passion or enchantment or something. that feels free to come out. And so we would do that in the workshops. And suddenly everyone comes back from the breakout rooms glowing, you know? And then we would ask them, so what were the conditions and how can we create some of those conditions, even for a day in your life, and see what happens to the writing? And a lot of what happened was that everybody would share what their process was, and then they would share what blocked them.
Interesting.
And there was a lot of empathy that was flowing in the room because everybody was now actually not performing for each other, but there was an open space to talk about the difficulty. Mm. And something about that created a kind of solidarity among the writers. And there was a sense of support where everybody was really attuning to each other. And two more things, we would ask them, okay, so if this was the last time the words flowed, let's see if tonight you can recreate some of that. Like whether it's going to a park and writing, or whether it's talking to someone who you feel safe with and writing. Just do like a page or two pages. And the next morning, so many people would come to the workshop and say, I wrote like a chapter. Or the beginnings of what became a chapter. A PhD student who took our class said, last night in 20 minutes, I managed to write down what I needed to write. And I had the first night of sleep I've had in months.
Wow.
Because I got it out. And then at the end of the workshop, you have people who said, I have permission. I had the permission to be in a process with others. And that, I think, is my dream for a classroom, right? Mm-hmm. A space where the point is to be real about what is required for learning. And to be in solidarity and support rather than a pressure to perform.
Yeah, no, I think that's so well said. And I can leave it at that because that sounds so right. I'm trying not to judge in a positive sense either, but this sounds really good too. But I think that thank you for sharing that because there is, I think, such power in that framework. And it's exciting to hear that you helped put together this framework and built the space to see in a workshop. And it sounds like this has helped shape and is part of the work that you have the Lab for Listening now, your partnership with Yuri, and you have your own coaching practice too. So I'd love to dig into this and see how have these processes played out for you, obviously. So you're doing two very amazing and really exciting kind of project work career paths. I don't know what the words for these things are anymore, vocations. That is exciting because it seems that this is some of the frameworks that you were like applying to yourself, but then also helping others go on this journey as well.
Yeah, thank you for the question. It is my first guinea pig. That's how I like to put it. And I think for me, when I started out initially, my question to go loop back to what you said about the UX stuff. Initially, when I was looking for what to do after grad school, I was sort of starting out with being like, okay, what is out there as a job that I can look for? Mm-hmm. That I can use some of my skills and fit myself into. And I kept getting this feeling of that alienation was cropping up in every place I looked. And I just couldn't see myself like not falling into the same trap. And my question to myself was like, what is that feeling I felt in that workshop of being inside myself? And how could I follow that in small incremental ways? And so initially I was just like, it's mediation work. And that was the thing that pulled me. Then we experimented, Yuri and I built the lab, and we continue to experiment with this workshop format. And then I just fell upon coaching. Like I had been exploring it, thinking about it, and I had my first call with the client. And at the end of that call, I was just like, this is it. I just had that feeling of being completely inside myself and feeling just deeply alive. And there was like there was no depletion. It wasn't exhausting. I had listened for an hour and I felt more energized than I felt going in.
Wow.
I think it's because I really enjoy being in that process with another person. It's an iterative thing. So I took a counterintuitive path. I didn't ask what was there that I could fit into, but I asked what was in here that I could express and see who I could find who would gel with that.
That sounds right on. And so refreshing too, that I imagine myself included here, that that folks listening to you share the story right now are, I want to do that. I want to have the courage to do that, and kind of, how do I be open to ask myself that question? What makes me feel alive? And then, to borrow another question, how do we create the conditions in which that can take place? I love that you took this counterintuitive approach and then found is the wrong word, built the kind of work that you wanted to do. This is very exciting. So tell me about the kinds of folks that you work with for your coaching practice, and what do you help accomplish? I'm just going to say, for folks that, on your website, it's very cool because it says, find your yes. And it's about discovering your needs and going on a journey to realize them. I'm hearing process. I'm hearing discovery. I'm hearing creativity. Yes. Tell me about what happens in this kind of work.
Yes, I think if I could condense what happens is that I really try to facilitate an empathetic space in which people can really discover what matters most to them and then figure out what's blocking them from achieving that or finding that or creating that in their life. And slowly, incrementally go through a process of unblocking it. And so this pans out in very different ways, in very different contexts. For instance, I work with people who are looking for work that makes them feel alive. Many of them are in jobs that provide them a lot of security, but they're alienated from themselves and they're like unhappy at work. Or it could be writers who find their work very meaningful, but then don't feel like there's financial support or structure or security. So that's one group of people I work with. Another group of people I work with is people who have been cut off from realizing that their needs matter, for one reason or the other. And there are structural conditions that have created this, right? So I work with a lot of women, for instance, who are doing a lot of tending of other people's needs in partnerships, in parenting, in elder care, in their professional lives. And the listening is a one-way process where they're doing all the work and it's not being reciprocated. Mm-hmm. Or they're in jobs that were chosen for them in a sense, or relationships they thought they should have rather than the relationships that they want to be in. And so it's really about supporting people and recognizing that their own needs and then drawing boundaries around themselves to shift away from more like imbalanced connections where reciprocity is not happening. And then the other group of people I work with, there are two more group of people who have a creative project that they're blocked from. So I worked with, for instance, someone who wanted to start a podcast and was stuck. And we worked for 6 weeks together. And at the end of it, he has a podcast. So that was like delightful and enjoyable.
That's good. If you're wondering, listeners, that was not me, but
that was not Adam.
It might be soon.
And the final group of people I work with are couples who I love working with couples because I bring the notion of situated perspectives in, because there's both so much intimacy and so much disconnection that happens in conflict when people can't see where the other person is coming from.
And it's almost like you're so close, you assume the person can essentially read your mind, or your nonverbal cues that you don't even realize you're doing sometimes. Yeah, that's an amazing set of groups of people to work with that I think all four are such important spaces in which we can provide that like room for listening and recognizing my needs count and how do we set boundaries? How do we create flow? It just sounds like such nice work. I know it's hard, but I think there's such a power in transformative work. I'm not sure what else I would call it, but transforming these spaces. And to call out a term you mentioned before about enchantment or re-enchanting one's life in space, I think it is such a powerful and fun antidote to the structural conditions and social circles that we force many of us to be in for various capacities. But just to call this out also, again, I think one of the powerful elements of your story too is that you have not only learned to find your flow, or you're find the process of the flow in which the current process is nice. Things may always change, of course, as a river.
Right.
Go down the river, but that's incredibly powerful and inspiring to hear. But also, like, the legit reality that you are building work and vocation doing this too, I think is very powerful for me to listen to, and I think for mm-hmm. others to hear as well. So I applaud that, because it's, A, the counterintuitive approach works, and there's work to be done, that it's about finding our space and what mm-hmm. makes us feel alive. And people are drawn to that too, I think. Like, we want to be a part of that and have that for ourselves, but then I think also see that in others. It's funny, it's like this incredibly social thing to take care of oneself. And taking care of oneself in the company of others is one of yes. the themes I'm feeling here. So that's really powerful. I don't know, so I just feel good. Thanks for...
No, it's so delightful to share. And I love what you said, that taking care of oneself is a social thing, right? Because I think that it doesn't have to be either or. And I think that a part of taking the counterintuitive path, it's scary. I'll say it. It felt like leaping into the dark without knowing our land. But a part of it, I think, is to affirm for ourselves that our needs matter too, that our needs for having agency over our time, having work relationships that are non-toxic, you know, and that are collaborative, that these things are luxuries to have, of course, in the world that we live in. But in whatever context we can, to carve out even some form of it where we can have access to work that's not alienating, can bring so much joy.
I agree 100%. And I think that's part of the point of why we're talking today as well. Thank you for this gift of conversation. And that I think that is like one of the greatest gifts that we can all give each other, is to help us unalienate. What's the opposite of alienate? Unify. Reunification. I appreciate, like, even the way, as we think about this too, in terms of the kinds of folks that you work with in your coaching practice, to just understand too that this is in all arenas of life, right? And so there's every space we have in every day gives us different opportunities to understand where the blockages are, where the lack of flow is, or where alienation is, and then provide ourselves the space to interrogate that and to not judge it, right? This makes me think too in terms of mindfulness practice. I used to deal with a lot of anxiety. I guess I'd be an anxious person, but it was very helpful in my own mindfulness practice in this case to not judge the anxiousness. Mm-hmm. Instead of saying, stop feeling anxious, it's saying, oh, look, that's the feeling of anxiety.
Yes.
And actually just saying, and I feel that way because I'm trying to protect myself. And that's a very right. different idea than quit being anxious.
Yes.
And so providing that space in the space for reflection and to be mindful about the things that we take for granted. We take for granted that the day is crappy, or that we feel anxious or something. And we don't need to do that. We have mm-hmm. space, and it's key for us to help people remind themselves of that, I guess. And share that space with others.
I love that. And then just one other thought that came to mind just hearing you is that, to me, it feels like a process of coming home to oneself without that home needing to be perfect.
Yeah. This is the perfect wraparound to the question of, can the anthropologist ever go home? The answer is yes. To themselves.
I love it.
Is there anything that I haven't asked, we haven't talked about yet, that you want to make sure to share? I will 100% be sharing your websites on the show notes so folks can check them out. I highly recommend everybody check out the practice and the work. But is there anything else that we haven't talked about that you want to make sure we share?
Yeah, I'm happy to share. One other thing that comes to mind is just in terms of things that we do, we teach so Yuri and I teach a course on conversations that connect.
Ooh, yeah.
Even when it's hard. And we love helping people experience what unalienated connection feels. I offer a free hour-long introductory call. So if anyone wants to just have an hour of empathy, they can sign up for free. Those are, you know, different ways to connect with us. And we run Flow every few months. So that's one other way. Just in terms of hanging out with us, we also hang out on Instagram at The Lab for Listening. So you can find us there. But mostly I want to say that I have learned the most from this process is this difficult and yet beautiful process of holding both authenticity and care together. And authenticity not in the notion of a monadic self, but a self in process of being able to really giving oneself permission to be real with oneself, you know, about what we need. What do we need to feel safe to write? What do we need to feel comfortable to speak? And rather than beat ourselves up saying that we're inadequate because we can't push past that, but to actually give ourselves the permission to go to people who hear us in a way we want to be heard and find context and spaces of writing where the words don't need effort to flow. And to find working relationships and collaborations where we don't have to perform.
I love it. Mic drop. Yeah, you. No, thank you so much for sharing the space today. I think it's super exciting to see that this work continues and grows. I wish you well in that. And so I hope that I know that the TAL community is super excited to share in this. I love this idea of being heard by people that hear you in a way that feels right to you. You said it better than that. But this idea, I think, is wonderful. That's a powerful takeaway. In an episode of Powerful Takeaways. So thank you so much for sharing the time today.
Oh, thank you so much, Adam. Thank you for the work that you're doing. It's been such a wonderful experience for me to talk to you. And it's, I think, so liberating to see people take anthropology in new directions. And you're sharing, you're not just doing your own journey, you're sharing it with the world. And it's a real gift. So thank you.
Thank you as well.
A huge thanks once again to Nethra Samara-Kramer for joining me on the podcast today. It has been a huge joy to talk with you. I recommend everybody check out her work. You'll see links for the Listen Up Lab and her coaching practice in the show notes below. If you found value in this episode, go ahead and share it with someone that you love. Maybe someone who's working on a blockage of their own or trying to figure out what their next personal or professional steps are. As always, I'd love to know what you thought about this episode. Did you find anything that resonated with you about the idea of nonviolent communication or how to provide space to be well to oneself, or perhaps what it might mean to even come home to oneself after being away for a while? I'd love to hear about it, so feel free to shoot me a message over at thisanthrolife@gmail.com, or you can shoot me a message over on our website, thisanthrolife.org. I always love talking with you and hearing from you, and again, as a reminder, I even met Nethra in the first place because of a TAL fan reaching out. So I always encourage you to do so, and we can't make these episodes without you, because, hey, you're part of the TAL family. And as well, make sure to check out the episode with Jeremy Pollock on conflict resolution and finding ways for effective communication and common ground. Thanks so much again for listening. Today's episode was produced by Sarah Schmieder and myself, Adam Gamwell. It has been a pleasure to be here with you, and we cannot wait to keep bringing you amazing content. I'm Adam Gamwell, and this is This Anthro Life.